for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A decade ago, DNA testing backed a long-lived rumor that Thomas Jefferson had fathered children with his slave, Sally Hemings. Few were more vindicated than Annette Gordon Reed, who had laid out a controversial case for that relationship just the year before. She then spent 9 years meticulously researching the lives of Sally Hemings, her children, and other relatives. Annette Gordon Reed joins me to talk about their stories and what they tell us about Jefferson and America. Her new book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, is the winner of the 2008 National Book Award. And we do invite your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. It's so good to see you, Annette.
It's good to be back.
You were here that more than a decade ago,
yes,
talking about Jefferson and his relationship with Sally Hemings. I remember some of the vituperative calls that came in that day from scholars who so firmly doubted your findings. Lots happened since then.
Well, I've sort of blocked those things out, but lots has happened since then, and mainly working on this book to try to, as you said, bring forth the story of the entire family. And it's been a long road. It was a fun road, and I'm just glad to be here at this point.
You open the book relating your experience with Thomas Jefferson's farm book, holding it, the original, in your hand. Tell us about that.
Well, I'd gone to the Massachusetts Historical Society to do a talk, and they were about to put the farm book away. It's a very, very old document, obviously, and they want to keep it preserved, and they were going to clean it and put a new cover and do everything, but take it off of public display. And the head of the Massachusetts Historical Society asked me if I would like to actually see the farm book. Now, the farm book is in most libraries, major libraries, in facsimile form. And so this was the first time I'd ever gotten the chance to actually hold the document, the book. And it was a stunning experience to me, one sort of unexpected, because there's just something different about an archive, an actual document that a person has created with their own hands, and this particular person, and also the record of enslaved people there, and these sort of neatly, you know, compiled lists and so forth, how many people get blankets, whose family lives where, and so forth. And it's a double, it's a very moving experience, because I'm obviously have always been interested and been writing about Jefferson and slavery, but also as an African American, to know that my ancestors probably were at some point in somebody's version of a farm book. So there were just a lot of complex feelings as I sat there that day. You have to have the detachment of a scholar, but there's still that feeling that this is something that's personal, too.
Annette Gordon Reed, she is professor of law at New York University, professor of history at Rutgers University, co-author with Vernon Jordan of Vernon Can't Read. Her newest book, which is the 2008 National Book Award winner, is titled The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. That subtitle, An American Family, was important to you.
Well, it was important because very often one of the things I wanted to try to do with this book was to have people think of enslaved people as people, not just as statistics, not as a part of a social group, but to emphasize the fact that they were mothers, fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, and that their story is very much the story of an American, one subset of the American people, a group of enslaved people. And so calling them a family and writing about them as brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers was a way I thought of personalizing their story.
And, as opposed to the anonymity of slavery.
Exactly.
Which is normally out there.
Exactly. I mean, they are, you know, enslaved people are a group. In much the same way in sort of modern times, to some degree, blacks are still viewed as a monolithic group as opposed to individuals who have family stories and traumas and successes and so forth in their families. And so that's what I wanted to focus on.
Help us to understand how Sally Hemings first came to Monticello, how she first came into Thomas Jefferson's life, and what happened after that.
Well, Sally Hemings, her real name was Sarah Hemings, was the daughter of Elizabeth Hemings, who was owned by a man named John Wales. John Wales happened to be Sally Hemings' father as well, and along with five other siblings he had with Elizabeth Hemings. John Wales was also the father of Jefferson's legal wife, Martha Wales. So when John Wales died in 17...
Wait just one second. What I want to do is clarify here that Sally Hemings became the daughter of John Wales by virtue of his relationship with a slave. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he was married to the woman who became Martha Jefferson, mm-hmm. The wife of Thomas Jefferson. He was married to her mother.
Yes. So Jefferson. All this is going on. To make a long story short, Sally Hemings and Jefferson's wife were half siblings, half sisters.
Right.
And so when John Wales died, they were inherited by Jefferson and Martha. The husband obviously controlled property during that time period. And so Sally Hemings came to Monticello in 1775. He died in 1774. It takes them time to settle the estate. So she comes there with her mother when she's about 3 years old, between 2 and 3 years old. And that was her, those would have been her first memories there at Monticello.
And what role did they have there at Monticello?
Well, Sally Hemings' older siblings, Robert and James Hemings, the two oldest, become sort of men servants to Jefferson, even though they're not men. Robert Hemings becomes Jefferson's manservant when he's 12. A man named Jupiter Evans had been Jefferson's manservant from the time he was at William and Mary. And even before then, he was a childhood companion to Jefferson. In fact, there is some belief that that Jupiter Evans' mother was Jefferson's wet nurse. So he was a person who had been with him from the very beginning of his life, and he replaced him with 12-year-old Robert Hemings, who then travels around with him. Robert is with him when he's in Philadelphia writing the Declaration of Independence. And so the Hemings siblings, these Hemings-Wales siblings, become the house servants to Jefferson and his wife, running errands for them and doing various things and being kept somewhat away, treated very differently from other people down the mountain. Robert and James, when they're old enough, and also another older brother who is a half-sibling, the men are allowed to hire their own time. They go away and hire themselves out, and they keep their money. So it's a very different, they're enslaved people, but it's a different life than other people at Monticello. And so that's how, that's what Sally Hemings and her siblings would have known from the very beginning, that they were at Monticello enslaved people, but they were different from other people.
And what was the relationship between Martha and her half-sister, Sally Hemings?
Well, we don't know. The one story that comes down is that when Martha was dying on her deathbed, she gave, the family lore is that she gave Sally Hemings a handbell as sort of as a memento.
And that, you have a photograph of that in the book.
That's it's owned by Howard University, but it's actually on display at Monticello right now. So we don't know how she felt about them other than that she brought them to live at her home, you know, as her favorite house servants.
Tell me about Isaac Jefferson, mm-hmm. and his memoirs, his storytelling, mm-hmm. what he related, mm-hmm. about the family.
Well, Isaac Jefferson, whose real last name was Granger, Jefferson was a name that was sort of given to him by by people. And I think also at some point when he had his business, he used the name Jefferson, but his real family name was Granger. He gave his recollections. He was a blacksmith in Petersburg after he leaves Monticello and is freed. And he gave his recollections to a man named Charles Campbell. And his statements are the most that we know about the relationships, about the Hemings family, who Elizabeth Hemings was, what she looked like, what Sally Hemings, he describes Sally Hemings, mentions a couple of her children, and gives sort of a picture of the family. So people have relied upon that very much to sort of get a portrait of what they were like, and just a few skeletal things about them as well.
Did the rest of the slave population there at Monticello live totally separately, totally apart from the way Sally Hemings and other members of her family lived?
Well, actually, the Granger family was, I mean, using these terms privileged, when you're talking about enslaved people, is fraught. You know, it's really problematic.
Of course.
But the Granger family would be the people who came the closest. But nobody, no other people, another man on the plantation got to go off and hire their own time. The Hemings women were exempted from field work. Even at harvest time, no matter what your job was, you were supposed to go into the fields to help bring in the harvest. They did not. So they were separate, apart, still enslaved people and not able to have total freedom, but different than most of the other people on the mountain.
Annette Gordon Reed, she is professor of law at New York University, professor of history at Rutgers University, author of the National Book Award winner, The Hemingses of Monticello. Please feel free to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's an email from Mark, who says, seriously, why does it matter? Why is this historically significant? How will the study of history be impacted if it is found to be true or utterly disproved? The question appears on first and last blush to be prurient to me.
Well, I think there's a tendency when you talk about people, so about relations between black people and white people, as seeing it as prurient. What is the point of writing about anybody's family? I mean, we write about Jefferson, we write about his wife, we write about his children, his grandchildren. That's not prurient. It's if you see Sally Hemings's, and by the way, this book is about much more than Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings.
Absolutely.
That's just a part of it. But if you write about, I mean, the sum total of Sally Hemings's life was not sex any more than the sum total of your mother's life or my mother's life or any woman's life is sex, because she had to have sex in order to produce children. This is a story of a mother, her children, a father, her sisters and brothers. It's not prurient. I mean, if it's no more prurient than writing about Jefferson and his wife and their children and grandchildren, it's a part of a family story. Now, if life at Monticello doesn't matter, then maybe if that's the view, I can understand it. But how do you write about the life of a man and not talk about seven children that he had, or four of them who lived to adulthood? So I don't see it as prurient at all.
It also, it seems to me, speaks to the whole relationship of how we view the separation between slave and slave master.
Mm-hmm. It is a way of talking about slavery in a way that it's not typically discussed through family stories, and which not to say that the sociological or sort of a group story of slavery isn't important, but it's an important window into the world of a world gone by. History is not just what powerful men do. It's about that, but it's also about the way people lived at a given time, and I think this story tells you that.
Here's an email from Janice in Houston, Texas, and this is for clarification. She says, it seems the last I heard, the DNA evidence showed only that the descendants of Sally Hemings were related to A. Jefferson, mm-hmm. possibly Thomas, but also possibly a relative, maybe a nephew. Has this been clarified, when and how?
Well, the DNA she's absolutely right. The DNA clarifies or says that the Hemings descendant was a descendant of a Jefferson. We don't have DNA proof that Jefferson was the father of anybody, not even his legal children with Martha. What you have is a genetic tie, along with the information that I present in the book that talks about what their names are, why they're named that way. They're all named for Jefferson's favorite relatives and best friends, the timing of her conceptions, testimony from his neighbors, the very fact that his family invented this story. I mean, the story was, and you'll remember back in our first discussion, was that the Carr brothers were the fathers of Sally Hemings' children. When the DNA disproved that, all of a sudden everybody forgot that there was this huge family story that insisted that it was the Carrs. So the question you ask is, why would Jefferson's grandchildren make up a story like that, lie on one set of relatives, to protect another set? They were trying to protect their grandfather. So it's a combination of DNA corroboration, which we don't have, by the way, for Jefferson and his legal descendants, and the information in the book.
Before DNA evidence or analysis backed your theory, what made you believe that Sally Hemings and Jefferson had children together?
Well, it was a combination of things. In my first book, when I reread it, and which I've only done once, I can see myself becoming more and more convinced as the story goes on. If I were writing it now, I would go back and redo the first part of it. But as I found more information, I think it's the timing of her conceptions and also the names of the children. Very often, when you're looking for an answer to something, the thing is right there in front of you. And I was sitting in my office one morning, looking at these names, and I thought, these are interesting names for these kids to have.
Give me some examples.
William Beverly is the oldest son. And I was trying to think, who is William Beverly? And when I found out that William Beverly was a man who went with Jefferson's father on an expedition, the two of them carved their names together on a tree during the course of this expedition. He was somebody that was very well thought of, an important person in Virginia history. Thomas Esten, the youngest son, Jefferson said was named for a favorite Jefferson cousin. Jefferson said that Thomas Esten Randolph's family and his family were as one. Harriet, who was the daughter, who was named for Jefferson's favorite son-in-law's sisters, and of course James Madison. Madison Hemings is really James Madison. So, you know, if you were looking at any other family, you would pay attention to the names of the people. What is the significance of this? And in this book, I mean, I actually found out why Jefferson was thinking about William Beverly during the time that Sally Hemings was pregnant. A man was writing to him about this guy and talking to him about his life and so forth. So I was able in this book to figure out, I know from the first one, who these people are. Now I was able to put together why Jefferson is named, why these people are named this, and what he was thinking about at the time.
It is clear, is it not, that some people continue, and some researchers, some analysts continue to deny that this relationship really existed.
Oh, and there will always be people who deny things. You know, there's no, I'm not at a point where I think I have to, I've never been at a point where I thought I had to convince 100% of people of anything. It's simply, you know, it's a question of evidence, but for some people it's a question of belief, and I never question people's beliefs.
Sally Hemings had 7 children, 4 of whom survived. They were actually freed after he died?
Well, 2 of them, the 2 eldest, left Monticello to live as white people. And if you're going to go live as white people, you don't want freedom papers, because that would be a tip-off that you were enslaved, in part, African-American. The youngest 2 were freed when Jefferson died, and they moved into Charlottesville and lived there with their mother until she died in 1835, and then they, after a while, moved to Ohio and started new lives.
They were also fairly light-skinned?
Oh, yes. The youngest one, Thomas Esten, or Esten Hemings, lived in Ohio for a time, and then, excuse me, I have a cold. For people who understand, I have a scratchy throat here.
It's all right.
After a while, left Ohio and moved to Wisconsin to live as a white man, and he changed his name to Esten Jefferson, S-E-H Jefferson, and lived as a white person. After a couple of generations, the family changes their story, because obviously you can't keep the story that you're descended from Jefferson if you're passing as a white person, because people would know that Jefferson had no legal white sons. So all of a sudden, the family, and this happens very often in families who pass, they create a new story for themselves. They drop, you know, Sally Hemings totally. I mean, her memory is pretty much erased in that family line, and they become descendants of Jefferson. I mean, of a Jefferson. They are, you know, Jefferson's brother or uncle or something like that, because they can't be descended from Jefferson anymore. So it's a very typical passing story in the black community.
Did the relationship, as your own research has unfolded, did the relationship with Sally Hemings begin while Martha was alive?
No. Sally Hemings, when Martha died, Sally Hemings was between 9 and 10 years old. And she dies in 1782. Jefferson, after a couple of years, goes to Paris, and Sally Hemings does not join him in Paris until 1787.
Why? Why did she join him in Paris at all?
Well, it's not his doing. It's not what he asked for. His youngest daughter was staying with his sister-in-law, who in this convoluted world was also Sally Hemings' half-sister. So she had been sent to live with Elizabeth Epps while Jefferson went to Paris and took his eldest daughter and James Hemings, Sally Hemings' older brother. She'd been left there with even a...
James Hemings was there going to learn to be a
French chef. Yeah, yeah. And so when Jefferson's youngest daughter, Lucy, dies, he wants his other daughter, Polly, sent over. So he asked that they send her with a mature, he says, a careful Negro woman such as Isabel, meaning Isabel Hearn, who was about 28 years old. But instead, Elizabeth Epps sent Polly, Jefferson's daughter, along with Sally Hemings, who was about 14 at that time. And they go first to London and stay with Abigail Adams for a time. And then they proceed on to Paris, and Sally Hemings takes up residence with her brother James at the Hotel Langeac. Both of them are paid wages, and she begins probably what obviously had to have been the most exciting part of her life. I mean, you can imagine being from Virginia, in the country of Virginia, all of a sudden being in the largest city in Europe, Paris, in the 1780s.
And she is dressed in beautiful clothing?
Well,
By comparison,
she makes enough of a salary to buy her own clothes. But Jefferson at some point begins to buy clothing for her, and it coincides with the time that his eldest daughter is going out into society, and she is described as acting as his daughter's lady's maid. So the thinking is, he really, if she's going to go out into society, she has to have clothes. So it seems to be about, because at the same time, his expenditures for his daughter go up as well. So this is about buying clothes that would make them both presentable out in society.
And how old is Sally Hemings at this point?
At this point, she's about 15 years old when she begins to go out. When she starts going out, she's about 15 or 16 years old.
When does Sally Hemings first become pregnant?
Well, the only thing we have is her son's statement that when they were about to leave Paris, she was pregnant, and that would be 1789, and she'd be 16 years old.
She has the first child back at Monticello.
Back in Virginia. The child does not live very long. There's no record of him. I mean, Jefferson doesn't begin to keep records of enslaved people at Monticello until 1794. The child evidently had died by that time. And then she has her next child in 1795, when she's 22 years old.
At 27, before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Before we open the phones, Annette, tell us about the lives of Sally's children and what happened to them, how well they fared.
Well, her children who lived to adulthood lived sort of a life outside of service at Monticello. The interesting thing about them that I sort of discovered and was sort of analyzing this time is that none of them were none of them were servants. They ran errands when they were little children, just like most kids run errands when they're small. The boys were trained to become carpenters and woodworkers. Jefferson was sort of a woodworker himself. He liked to make furniture, and he spent a lot of time with John Hemings, who was the boy's uncle, Sally Hemings, his brother, youngest brother. And so they spent actually quite a bit of time with Jefferson. When he goes to Poplar Forest, he goes with John Hemings and his two assistants. And depending upon the year, those two assistants would either be Beverly and Madison or Madison and Esten. And I hadn't, when I worked on the first book, I hadn't worked all of this out. But looking at the correspondence, you can see that during Jefferson's retirement, they are up at Poplar Forest quite a bit together. The daughter, instead of becoming a lady's maid to Jefferson's granddaughters, which would have happened probably in another household, becomes a spinner. She learns how to spin on a spinning wheel, and which is another sort of womanly thing to do. Jefferson's mother was a spinner. It was nothing, you know, when you think of enslaved women, you think of part of the way that they were differentiated from upper-class white women, or most women, was that they went to the fields. But spinning and sewing, that sort of, Jefferson saw that as sort of a basic woman's job for doing. So these are kids who know that they're going to be free when they're grown, who are at Monticello not developing identity as servants, but developing skills that they will use in their lives. Harriet to become a wife and a mother, and the sons to become carpenters and musicians. All of them played the violin. And Esten actually makes his living as a violinist when he's an adult. So it's an odd thing to contemplate. You know, think of your father as your owner, but this is the kind of thing that happened quite a bit in the South. There's nothing, it's odd to us because we think this is Jefferson, but this is not an uncommon story.
Through his writings then, and through his association with these children, did you see a change in Jefferson's writings about slavery?
No. I think Jefferson decided early on that there was not going to be a real solution, solution to the problem of slavery, to the issue of slavery during his lifetime. You know, sort of, oh, this will never happen in our lifetime, like we'll never have a black president in our lifetime. People decide the things that they think are possible. And I think he decided pretty early on, by the 1790s certainly, that nothing was going to be done about this. And see, he doesn't really change. He does, I mean, it's interesting. He has this idea that, and this was the position of many people, that slavery should be ended, but that black people and white people would not be able to live together in peace in America, and that black people should be expatriated. But interestingly, when he writes his will, even though lots of slave owners, well, not, I don't want to say lots, but a number of slaveholders were arranging to have their the people they emancipated sent to Liberia, he doesn't do that. He frees Madison and Esten and also some of their uncles, and he petitions the legislature to allow them to remain in the state, because if he didn't do that, they would be forced to leave or re-enslaved in a year. So there's this public rhetoric about emancipation but expatriation, but in his own life, he doesn't do that.
The book is titled The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, Annette Gordon Reed, and the book is the National Book Award winner for 2008. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Clarence King was a famed explorer, scientist, and hero of the late 19th century. But the blue-eyed, fair-skinned King also led a secret double life passing as a black man, and only revealed his true identity to his wife on his deathbed. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Annette Gordon Reed is with me. We're talking about her brand new National Book Award winning book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. Here's an email from Liz, who says, while we can never know whether the relationship was actually one of love and respect, certainly Sally was not his legal equal and was in a place of disadvantage in this relationship, would she have had the option to refuse his advances? Does your guest have any insights on putting this relationship within the social context of the time? It seems this imbalanced relationship reflects not only the total lack of rights for slaves, but also the disadvantage of women in general. Yet at this time, Jefferson and others were writing about equality among men.
That's a fascinating point. Once she comes back to America, she has no rights because she is enslaved.
Did she have the option to stay in Paris?
Oh, absolutely, she had the option to stay in Paris.
But she was already pregnant.
She was pregnant, and he promised her that if she would come back, she would have a nice life, and her children would be freed when they were 21. You have to remember her mother is here, her siblings are here, her whole way of life is here. She thought about staying. Her brother begins to prepare himself to stay. He hires a tutor to teach him proper French grammar, but Jefferson persuades them to come back. So, you know, certainly while she's in France, which is essentially free soil, she could have stayed there, and a number of blacks did. There was a black community in Paris, and most of the people there were free, and they were cooperative, and they helped one another. So very often people think of them as being totally alone, but they would not have been totally alone had she stayed there. But once she comes back, of course, she's enslaved, and she couldn't, at that point, you know, refuse him. But as the questioner is saying here, wives couldn't refuse their husbands either. So we're talking about, I mean, obviously the continuum is, there's a big gap between a free white woman and an enslaved black woman. But some of the disabilities of women at that time are the things that we don't think about very, very much. And they were talking about equality, but it was equality that basically viewed women, children, and slaves as under the control of white men. So it was an equality for white men, equality that we think of, but they saw it as it's this paternalistic relationship between husbands and wives, slaves and children are all in the same category.
All right. We'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting discussion. I want to reference Mark's comments. And usually his comments are typical of white male Americans because they want to know, why should I even be interested in this? And when you think about slavery, it's one of those hidden secrets in American society. And case in point, I am also from Virginia. And one day I was at a dinner party with friends, and I was the only African American there. And they started talking about the origins of their names or their last names. And when I finally stated that my grandfather's family was owned by an Irishman named Taylor in Virginia, the room just got quiet. And someone finally said, "So your family, your descendants of slaves?" And I said, "Yes." And you know, and that brought on a larger conversation. So, in a lot of cases, people, because of the absence of slavery in history books, they don't really understand the impact of it on Americans. So, for taking my comments.
All right. Thanks for calling. Any thoughts?
Well, it's sort of an amazing notion that people wouldn't know that he was a descendant of enslaved people. African people, people of African origin are in the American hemisphere by and large. Because unless, of course, they're Africans who've recently immigrated here, but are descendants of slaves. I am, and that's something to be expected.
Where was your family?
I'm from Texas. My family, I can trace back into the 1860s in Texas. Before then, my father's family was from Georgia, and my mother's family was from Alabama.
Do you know how they worked as slaves?
No, I don't. I'm supposing my great-grandmother had a cotton, and great-grandparents had a cotton farm, so I suppose they picked cotton before the end of slavery. My father's family, after my came out of slavery and bought 300 acres of land, and they became lumberjacks down in East Texas. But I'm not sure what they did before.
All right, let's go now to Birmingham, Alabama. Eric, good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. It's a privilege to talk to you. I used to call into your show some 30 years ago when I lived in the Washington area.
Glad to have you with us. Thank you.
Yeah, I just had a couple of quick points. First of all, I just want to say I'm elated that your guest was bringing to the surface a subject that's been so sensitive and touchy and something that this country has not wanted to deal with in a long time. Of course, a lot of that changed on Election Day. It shows the progress we've had. But the gentleman that just called, I think we missed a point that he was bringing up. I was in a similar circumstance. I think what may have been going on is that he was of a very light complexion, and they were stunned to find out that he was related to Africans. I don't particularly use the phrase biracial to describe myself. My father very obviously is the byproduct. I believe his grandfather is white. My great-grandmother is a black woman. But going along with what your guest said about the Hemings children working in the house, there's a long-held notion, and it's obviously true, that the lighter-skinned black people were given privileged positions, and the darker ones were condemned to live in the fields. And it's played itself out even throughout the years recently. Even the department stores in the 50s where the lighter-skinned black people were given favorable treatment and the darker ones were denied employment. And just a very quick follow-up to the gentleman that emailed earlier and said, why is this important? And I think it is because when you have people like Strom Thurmond and Thomas Jefferson who are adamantly against integration, but yet they're the father of black children. I mean, it's something that should be discussed and not hidden.
I'm glad you called. Were you surprised to learn about Strom Thurmond?
Well, actually, I didn't know very many people from South Carolina, but whenever I met them, that was one of the things that they would say out of the blue. There had been rumors about it. It was sort of a shocking thing, the way it came about, that she actually stood up and said this. And, you know, my son said she looked like Strom Thurmond in a wig and a dress. And, you know, telling this story with her documentation and so forth, it was an amazing kind of thing. But here's this guy who's saying, you know, we can't have black people in our swimming pools. And he goes away from that speech and goes down to visit his daughter at this college that he's sending her to. It's just bizarre. I mean, it just really shows you how twisted racial relations
and hypocritical
things were at that time period.
Now, our caller also made the point about lighter-skinned Africans or African-Americans who made their way more easily than darker-skinned and in the 50s got the department store jobs and so on. Would you agree with that?
Well, there's certainly, I mean, research that's done that suggests that people are comfortable with folks who look more like them. And if you figure that a number of these people in the house were the relatives of these folks, I mean, if it's the Jefferson-type situation, it makes sense. But I would say that there were lots of light-skinned slaves in the fields, too. And there were lots of people who were sold and lots of people who were mistreated. I mean, the real thing was having any amount of African blood in you was a way of making you a disfavored person in society.
Of course, we now have Barack Obama, the product of a black male and a white female. What does that tell you about America's progress in this regard, looking at race?
Well, it's interesting. He's had sort of an interesting row to hoe here, because at the beginning, people said he wasn't black enough. There was a question, is he black enough? And then he's, you know, too black, and now is he black at all? I think it may have been easier for some whites to accept him because he had a white mother. I have a colleague who says it suggested that if his father had been white and his mother had been black, there might be a different view of him. I don't know. His theory was that, you know, if people are afraid of what he's going to do, the notion is that you're not going to hate mommy. Essentially, if mommy is the person who's raising you, then that's... So that was just his theory. But certainly there is a sense that among some people that they emphasize his whiteness. But if you were to see him, I mean, he looks like an everyday African-American person. There's nothing about him that would suggest that his mother is a white person. So I do think the knowledge may influence some people, but by and large, his appearance-wise, he is typical-looking.
All right, let's go now to St. Louis, Missouri. Myna, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
Your inspiration. And I want to thank Ms. Gordon-Reed for writing these books. I think it's fascinating. And I think if you have to ask why it's important, you're just never going to get it. However, my question is, it kind of goes back to the beginning of the conversation about how some of the slaves and members of families were treated especially well. Well, a privileged slave, I suppose, is an oxymoron, but is there any sort of written documentation or written history about how families, slave families, got along with each other, where there were those who were made to work in fields and those who were made to, who were allowed to work in the home and not do the field work? I'm just curious.
Sure.
I know the majority of that sort of history is oral, but I just didn't know if there was any sort of documentation of how families got along who were treated, you know, members of the same family who were treated differently.
Well, I mean, certainly there are. Oral history usually refers to a situation where someone's great-great-grandchildren or descendants recount stories from a particular time. But there are certainly narratives of enslaved people who lived during the time who talked about that sort of thing. The historian Michael Gomez has written a book called Our Country Marks, and he talks about relations between enslaved people, different types of enslaved people. I mean, certainly at Monticello, Jefferson's grandchildren, one of his grandsons said that a number of the enslaved people there were jealous of the Hemings family and resentful of them. But on the, by the same token, we know that there was cooperation. I think it really depends. It's sort of hard to make these broad, sweeping generalizations. It was mainly about how people acted as whether or not they would get along or not.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Raleigh, North Carolina, good morning, Dave.
Hi. My mother passed in 1938, meaning she became white in 1938 after being, I don't know, some part black. She did that to get out of, to be able to finish high school, and they moved from Louisa County to Charlottesville, Virginia. I was, you know, very interesting because a lot of the Hemings or people related to them were in Louisa County, and I tried to do my genealogy and get back because I would be absolutely thrilled to be descended from Sally Hemings. She was a charming, intelligent, resourceful woman, and I think the reason she was taken to Paris was because of just that. I think Jefferson's daughter had a lot of sense to bring her along because she would be certainly a lot more fun than a serious I was a 28-year-old person, but the thing is, I would not be proud to be descended from Thomas Jefferson if this is true, if this is what he did, took advantage of someone in that situation, and I think you're indicting Thomas Jefferson of something that is so inconsistent with the whole rest of his life, his behavior in Paris, his writings, his diary. This is so inconsistent with him. It's like, you know, you have to have motive in order to convict somebody of something, and this just doesn't add up. And I'm sorry, you know, if it thrills somebody to be descended from someone who would do something like that, I'm sorry that their values are so out of whack. But I just can't believe this was Jefferson. I think it was his nephew and other relatives in the family who certainly did have, there were certainly mental problems or sociopathic problems.
Annette?
Well, I mean, there's a lot there. We don't really know anything about Jefferson and his nephews. I mean, so this is one of the things that happens in history. It's not out of character with Jefferson. I mean, I have studied Jefferson's life for years now. I've spent the last 9 years going through documents, going through letters, documentation, things at Monticello. And there's no way to say it's out of character for him. And we certainly don't know enough about, we don't have any idea that his nephews or brothers or anybody were sociopathic or anything. I mean, it's one of the things you have to be careful about is using scapegoats, is because you don't know anything about a person. You can say anything at all about them. These were men who had wives and children. And to say, when nobody said at the time that they were the fathers of these children, to make them the fathers of these children is just not fair to them, just because they don't happen to be Thomas Jefferson and you can say anything at all about them. But I can say it's not out of character with Jefferson.
Here's a final email from Patricia in Houston, who says, I recently read this book, would like to offer my own testimonial. It is anything but prurient. It's an important book about the American people and their history, written with great sensitivity and respect for all involved. as well as with a high level of historical integrity. Kudos and thank you, Ms. Gordon Reed. And I thank you, Annette Gordon Reed, for being here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, even though I'm not in good voice.
You were fine. The book is titled The Hemingses of Monticello. It won the National Book Award for 2008. Annette Gordon Reed is professor of law at New York Law School and professor of history at Rutgers University. Thanks to all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.